that it has been unprecedented. About myself returning, they also asked me the same question at Cannes. And I said, I will immediately return after the festival. And 24 hours after the end of the festival, I was in Tehran airport. Since I left Iran for the film campaign, of course, I heard that I have a new prison sentence. 1 year prison sentence and 2 years banned, and 2 years being banned from work. My trial happened in absentia, and my lawyer was supposed to give me the final results, but then the internet was shut down and the phones are shut down, and I have not heard from my lawyer. But as soon as the campaign ends, as I have said before, I will return to Iran in any possible way, under any circumstances, because it is there that I know I have to exist. It is there where I know I can make films and do what I like to do. Yes, I will return. I will definitely return.
The acclaimed Iranian filmmaker Jafar Panahi. Special thanks to Shaida Dayani. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheh. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
New year, new KBOO. Thank you to everyone who contributed and supported us during our KBOO Fights Back end of year campaign. With help from our community, we exceeded our $75,000 goal and will be able to continue bringing you grassroots independent community radio.
Tune in to KBOO every third Saturday at 10 p.m. for Query. Dive into the spectrum of queer music as we explore artists across time and genre.
It's on my mind every hour of every day.
That's Query, every third Saturday at 10 p.m.
The things we could do, oh, it takes my breath away.
Here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And I lose control.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, what a federal judge says about the Trump administration's efforts to get more personal information about Oregon voters. 1 in 8 Oregonians are worried they won't have enough food. And Portland City Council elects 2 new leaders. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January 15th, 2026. I'm Annette Newell. So glad to have you with us tonight. The federal government appears concerned about Oregon's high rates of voter registration. It also appears to want to create a national voter registration list after asking the state for extremely personal information and being turned down. The government sued Oregon. KBOO's Josh Salem tells us about a preliminary ruling in that lawsuit.
A federal judge tentatively ruled last night that Oregon does not have to give the federal government personally identifiable data of more than 3 million Oregon voters. U.S. District Court Judge Mustafa Kasubai said he plans to dismiss the U.S. Justice Department's lawsuit against Oregon and Secretary of State Tobias Reid. Kasubai, appointed by former President Joe Biden, did admit that his final written decision may be different. Reid still called the ruling a big win for Oregonians' privacy and the rule of law. He said, quote, "The federal government tried to abuse their power to force me to break my oath of office and hand over your private data. I stood up to them and said no. Now the court sided with us. Tonight we proved once again we have the power to push back and win." End quote. The U.S. Department of Justice demanded last summer that Oregon and other states deliver a wide range of information, including the full name, date of birth, residential address, and driver's license number or partial social security number, for every registered voter. Reid refused, saying that doing so would violate Oregonians' privacy rights and that the federal government had no authority to demand that data. The federal government then sued Oregon in September. The lawsuit alleges the state violated the National Voter Registration Act, the Help America Vote Act, in Title III of the Civil Rights Act of 1960 by not turning over voter data. The case yesterday, heard in Eugene, was to decide whether to dismiss the suit. The judge said, quote, "I'm very cautious and doubtful that what you're asking for, which is an unredacted list, is actually going to give you the information that you need to establish a violation of two voting-related laws," end quote. Oregon does regularly provide a redacted version of its voter registration list to political parties and voter outreach groups, and the state offered to give that redacted list to the federal government. That list includes voter names, addresses, political parties, and birth years, but not birth dates or months, social security numbers, or driver's license numbers. State leaders and the nonprofit group Our Oregon, which is involved in the case, have cited concerns that the Department of Justice wants to use voter data for immigration enforcement. It's both illegal and extremely rare for non-citizens to vote. One study of a national election found only 30 cases of suspected non-citizen voting, or 0.0001% of votes cast. Oregon recently found more than 1,800 people were registered to vote in error. They had not provided documents indicating they were citizens while at the state's Motor Vehicle Services Division. Only 39 of those people voted, and several of them later said that they were citizens when they did actually vote. The Secretary of State's office added guardrails to prevent similar mistakes. Some experts think the federal government is trying to create a national voter registration list to run through databases held by the Department of Homeland Security. The federal government appears suspicious of Oregon's voter rolls, and partly because the state has registered more eligible voters than the national average. In November of 2024, more than 95% of U.S. citizens aged 18 or older in Oregon were registered to vote, compared to 73.6% of adult citizens nationwide. Oregon was the first state in the nation to automatically register adult citizens to vote when they obtain or renew driver's licenses or state ID cards at the Motor Vehicle Services Division. We also regularly lead the nation in voter turnout. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
A new report shows a large amount of Oregonians are food insecure. As Isabel Charlet reports, the rate has not dropped since COVID.
Nearly 1 in 8 Oregonians experienced food insecurity in 2024, a rate that mirrors the national average and has remained high since the pandemic, according to the latest report from the USDA. Advocates fighting hunger in the state note the new report only tracks data through 2024, meaning the numbers don't capture the impact of recent cuts to SNAP. Chris Baker with the Oregon Hunger Task Force notes the true picture is likely more severe, with food banks, pantries, and mutual aid groups now seeing a growing demand for help.
We're really seeing an unprecedented strain on food providers right now, which we also saw during the government shutdown and the SNAP freeze that followed.
She adds over 300,000 Oregonians have lost or have reduced SNAP benefits since H.R. 1, the Trump administration's budget reconciliation bill, was passed in July. Baker says for the upcoming 2026 legislative session, the task force is urging action to strengthen food access and prevent fraud. Mark Edwards, director of the Oregon State University Policy Analysis Lab, says this USDA report is the last of its kind for now, as the Trump administration has halted this data collection. He calls it the country's most comprehensive tool for evaluating and guiding hunger policies. Without it, he warns, effective policymaking at both the state and national level will be harder.
When we don't know the current level of need, or we can't tell how it's changing, that leaves us in the dark.
He adds OSU has been producing an annual report for the last 20 years based on USDA data detailing how different demographics are impacted by food insecurity in Oregon. He says this year's report will be the last until the federal data collection resumes. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
After several days and hours of deadlock and debate, the Portland City Council has elected its next president. He is District 1 Councilor Jamie Dunphy, an East Portland representative and member of the council's Progressive Caucus. He won the job during the 13th round of voting that occurred across 3 days and immediately got to work. After the vote, Dunphy said,
"Yep. First gavel, I'm breaking the gavel. Good afternoon, friends. I'm bringing this meeting of the City Council back to order.
Thank you.
Colleagues, I'm going to take a moment just to say thank you for your confidence. And to those who, I will earn the dignity of this office. I will earn the trust of my colleagues. I am so grateful to be the first City Council president representing East Portland. This is going to be a hard year, and I need all of you, and I will do my best, and I will make mistakes, and I will work with each of you to find what is best for the city. Thank you for your dedication to this work.
District 1 Councilor Jamie Dunphy was elected council president with a majority vote of 9, succeeding former council president Elena Pirtle-Ginney. The council members chose District 4 Councilor Olivia Clark as the council vice president with a majority vote of 11, succeeding former Vice President Tiffany Coya Mullane. Washington U.S. Senator Patty Murray spoke out at a health committee hearing in the nation's capital on the safety of a drug commonly used for abortions.
Medication abortion is safe and effective, and we have known that for a very long time. FDA had the data to show this when they first approved mifepristone 25 years ago, and its safety was reaffirmed when FDA approved a generic version of this last fall. We have a tremendous amount of data showing how safe this medication is. More than 160 high-quality studies have been conducted, and millions of women around the world use mifepristone safely every year, with fewer complications, by the way, than Viagra or penicillin. The fact of the matter is, mifepristone is one of the most studied medications we have. In fact, in October, a federal court ruled that FDA's current restrictions on mifepristone are illogical and unsupported by the evidence. The only reason mifepristone is regulated as heavily as it already is because of anti-abortion politics, not because of science. And now Republicans are holding this hearing to peddle debunked junk studies by anti-abortion organizations, which have no credibility and have been forcefully condemned to act by actual medical organizations, to justify reinstating more burdensome requirements and ultimately ripping medication abortion off the shelves entirely. We all know this hearing is not about the actual science or the facts, and it's certainly not about what is best for women's health. This hearing really is about the fact that Trump and his anti-abortion allies want to ban abortion nationwide, and medication abortion is the most common method of abortion in the U.S. Republicans are furious that despite their extreme abortion bans, some women are still finding ways to get the care that they need, and they want to put a stop to it, whatever it takes. Of course, the overwhelming majority of people in this country do not want medication abortion ripped away, and they do not want Republicans legislating their pregnancies. And I think most people are going to see right through the utter BS that is being staged here. I also have to say I'm stunned that Republicans found time to hold this sham hearing when they have yet to have held any sort of hearing holding RFK Jr. to account for undermining access to safe and effective vaccines and letting deadly diseases like measles and whooping cough rip through our communities.
Meantime, Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden is worried about the impact of huge hikes in health care costs as a deadline looms this week.
The final day for Americans to sign up for health insurance through the Affordable Care Act marketplace. After that, the doors slam shut, high premiums are locked in, millions of families all across the land will be unable to afford essential care. On this side of the aisle, we've been working for more than a year to develop bipartisan support to prevent this from happening. We told our Republican colleagues we wanted to work with them long before Donald Trump was sworn in. Democrats spent the summer warning about the dangers of higher premiums while Republicans were forcing through the largest cut in history. We pressed for action before the sign-up period began. At every turn, Donald Trump and congressional Republicans slammed the door in the face of millions of Americans seeking premium relief. It's clear why. Yesterday, the Republican Study Committee, which constitutes a majority of the House Republican Conference, released yet another new plan to unleash another set of harmful partisan changes to Americans' health care. This is being done when millions are already reeling from the cuts that we saw to Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act in the last bill. The new draft plan contains yet another $1 trillion in cuts to health care, which, if passed, would represent a knockout blow to the American health care system. Once again, another hacksaw to Medicaid targeting blue states and cities in yet another attempt to weaponize the federal government against the Republicans' political opponents. This new Republican plan would unleash insurance companies and shady brokers to push more junk plans that I can tell you aren't worth the paper they're written on. Americans are fed up with high health care costs, and yet Republicans now want to double down on misery and once again allow these Swiss cheese health plans that don't cover health care like chemotherapy or prescription drugs. The mask is off. It's clear Republicans haven't been serious about holding premiums down from the start. All the hemming and hawing about health care premiums and taking on big insurance has been for show, and the American people are fed up with excuses. Today is an opportunity, finally, to do the right thing. Senator Schumer's made it clear that extending the tax credits for middle-class health care is a key first step towards moving America towards a health care system that puts our families first.
Oregon Congresswoman Andrea Salinas told fellow lawmakers about the importance of her district's transportation and infrastructure projects for the Pacific Northwest economy.
Excited to be here to be able to share Oregon's 6th district priorities. The I-5 corridor is the most important transportation artery across the Pacific Northwest. Access to I-5 is essential for economic development, allowing businesses to get their goods to market. In my district, one of the most important projects undertaken in recent years is the Newburgh-Dundee Bypass. This highway improvement is a critical link to bringing existing and anticipated economic development to this rural region by creating a safer, more efficient connection between these rural communities and I-5. My local stakeholders estimate that finishing this project could create over 6,000 new manufacturing jobs alone by improving the movement of goods on the west side of the Willamette Valley to the heart of my district through Interstate 5. It will also provide significant safety improvements by moving freight traffic off of our local roads. The corridor is part of Oregon's critical rural freight network used by more than 3,000 trucks a day. From 2018 to 22, this corridor experienced 141 crashes, including 11 fatal or serious injury crashes, highlighting the urgent need for these safety improvements. While increasing the capacity to transport goods to I-5 was critical, it is not the sole goal. The highway itself also needs upgrades to improve capacity and seismic resiliency. We have those earthquakes out on the west. The I-5 Boone Bridge crosses the Willamette River in Wilsonville, just south of Portland, and is a critical link for freight moving up and down the West Coast. The bridge is part of Oregon's designated seismic lifeline route and is at serious risk of failure in a Cascadia subduction zone earthquake. More than 126,000 vehicles, including an average of 17,000 trucks, cross the bridge each day. We must replace the bridge to adapt to economic growth in the region and ensure the safety of our communities from natural disasters. We also desperately need to improve the junction of Highway 51 and Oregon 22, which is the primary route for tourism and freight to the Oregon coast, and for people to access that amazing Pinot Noir wine that everyone loves. According to Oregon Department of Transportation statistics, this junction saw 154 crashes between 2016 and 2022, with 10 resulting in fatalities. Not only is the junction itself dangerous, it provides critical access to Salem's Regional Trauma Center for residents of Polk and Yamhill counties who deserve those safe and accessible roadways when every second really matters. All of these projects have strong financial support from local and state governments, but they cannot get over the finish line without federal support. As your committee prepares to advance the multi-year surface transportation re-auth, I urge you to consider the impact on projects just like these and offer your strong support for the federal partnerships that actually make them possible. Federal competitive grant programs are essential tools for projects like these, but they are often oversubscribed and underfunded. Programs like BUILD and MEGA can help make these projects pencil out. I encourage you to consider providing as much flexibility as possible for these funding opportunities to allow the Department of Transportation to tailor its support to the specific needs of the project. Rural grants are especially important. This program is designed to help projects in rural areas that are also often overlooked. Importantly, rural grants can cover up to 100% of the project cost. This flexibility allows large projects to move forward in under-resourced communities like mine.
House Democrats are backing an effort to impeach Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem. The Senate GOP blocks an effort to limit executive war powers in Venezuela, And a federal judge rejects a Republican plan to overturn California's new congressional maps. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2026 Talks.
Secretary Noem has brought her reign of terror to the Chicagoland area, L.A., New Orleans, and communities north to south to east to west.
Illinois Democratic Representative Robin Kelly is calling for Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem's removal from office. Articles of impeachment claim Noem obstructed congressional oversight, compromised public safety, violated due process rights, and used her office for personal benefit. So far, 70 members of Congress have signed on. The killing of 37-year-old Renee Nicole Good at a Minneapolis immigration raid sparked more than 1,000 protests. Protests nationwide. The Senate narrowly rejected a war powers resolution limiting President Donald Trump's ability to further strike Venezuela. That after two Republicans who had favored it switched their votes under pressure from the White House. Senate Majority Leader John Thune called the resolution unnecessary after Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro's capture earlier this month. Thune says Democrats are giving in to, quote, anti-Trump hysteria.
Back during the first Trump administration, Democrats were calling for the ouster of Maduro and were criticizing the president for not going far enough in opposing the Maduro regime.
The vote still signifies an increasing willingness to stand up to Trump's use of the military. Since Maduro's capture, Trump has increasingly said the U.S. will take control of Greenland from Denmark by force if needed. North Carolina Republican Tom Tillis calls that, quote, absurd.
We had as many as 17 military installations in Greenland at our height, and once we get through this tension that we have today, they would be willing to accept us.
A federal court rejected a GOP attempt to block California's new voter-approved congressional maps. Republicans argued the new districts were racially gerrymandered to favor Hispanic voters. The court found neither party made that claim during legislative debate and ruled the maps were a partisan, not racial gerrymander, which is allowed under the Voting Rights Act. The case could go to the Supreme Court. Despite Trump's repeated claims of widespread non-citizen voting in the last election, preliminary investigations show quite the opposite. Of nearly 50 million voter registrations checked, only 10,000, less than 0.25%, were referred for review as possibly non-citizens, and many of those may have actually been citizens. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
What will historians write about decades from now when they look back at the events of the past year? I had a chance to check in with Dr. Chris Nichols, a former Oregon State University professor who is now with Ohio State University, for his thoughts about that.
2025, was there any one thing in particular that stood out to you that you said, that's going to be in the history books years from now?
I'll take one that people probably weren't thinking about. The first American pope.
Yeah.
A pope born and raised in the south side of Chicago, fan of American baseball, went to Villanova. In the greater scheme of things, and Catholic history, religious history, the U.S.'s role in the world, the U.S. as, through much of its history, being anti-Catholic, that seems really significant, actually. And it's a small thing in some ways, and it's not a spectacular thing, and it's definitely not a sad thing. So it's nice to pull out one of those. And he had a lot of support, apparently. So there's that. I think that's one that's pretty significant for us to consider. One of the things I think in the Pacific Northwest that's important, and we were talking about this before we came on to have this conversation, was how much the state of Oregon battled the federal government. More than 50 lawsuits, by my count and by the reporting that I've seen, spending quite a bit of money on those cases, but actually ensuring that 100 times that amount came back to the state of Oregon in federal funds and appropriations that were already in the works. Everything from defending H-1B visas and SNAP benefits to fighting back against the federalization of the State Guard to working for emergency grants and cultural institutions across every sector of society. Oregon was one of the leading states in pushing back against federal overreach. At least Oregonians and residents of the Pacific Northwest can be proud of in 2025 and looking forward. And certainly something as a former Oregonian I'm proud of. I think that's impressive work. It's not easy, and it takes diligence and time and money and a willingness to sometimes lose and to pick your battles, and all of which is a testament to Oregon, the state, and Oregonians standing up for their rights.
Yeah, right now the Supreme Court is considering the tariff case, and that's Oregon versus Trump. That was started by our own Attorney General here, Dan Rayfield. And like you said, over 50 lawsuits he's filed in this term. And he's had some success, some failure, but pretty much it sounds like the way the justices were talking, it sounded like they were saying there isn't really a historical precedence for the president to set tariffs in our nation's history. So they were using that argument pretty first and foremost. They were, it seemed skeptical that he has the right to do that.
Yeah, most of the historians I know, particularly those of us who work on the Gilded Age and Progressive Era, when tariffs were the sort of cutting edge policy instrument, see it that way too, that the precedent-setting dimensions come in the 1930s, which was something under the Roosevelt administration allowing the president to set those tariffs. But that was through expert review, and the point was that Congress wasn't the appropriate place to do that expert review, and there wouldn't be these kind of broad-based tariffs that we've seen and then had going back and forth really rapidly, and with implementation being not set in advance and strategies not clear and outcomes and leverage far from certain. So the takeaway there is that the historical precedents really don't add up to a whole to support Trump's claims on this. And in other eras, it was absolutely a congressional act and did not have presidential powers. Not until the 30s that you have that delegation from Congress to the president, and it was not intended for this.
Chief Justice Roberts was specifically stating tariffs are a tax, aren't they? Who pays them? It's the American people. And he did get them to say that. So I think that seemed to be the center of what the Chief Justice was saying about that. So
I think there's a very strong case against. There's a political case to support the president if you're a Republican. But in terms of law and precedent, there's a very strong case against allowing presidents to essentially willy-nilly raise and lower tariffs.
Thanks to historian and Professor Chris Nichols for that interview. And the current political climate in the U.S. is making jobs tougher to find for trans people. Roz Brown has that story.
A majority of Americans express support for policies that protect transgender people from discrimination, but many in the trans community still struggle to find a job. The Pew Research Center says the political climate has changed many people's views on transgender issues, although 56% of adults still support policies aimed at protecting them from discrimination in jobs, housing, and public spaces. Tony Newman leads California's Trans Can Work and assists some 100 trans individuals every month in finding employment.
We're not looking for anything else, but what every other American needs is economic and financial security in 2026.
Newman says Trans Can Work seeks out companies willing to hire qualified transgender folks and then encourages them to post an open position on the nonprofit's job board. She notes they do not try to change a company's culture to be more accepting, but rather act as an intermediary service to help trans people find a job, achieve economic security, and maintain a healthy life. Transgender workers report unemployment at twice the rate of the population as a whole, and many who are currently working say they're underemployed. Newman says some people, including those responsible for hiring within their companies, have never met or interacted with a transgender person, and that's where Trans Can Work can lend support.
We offer training. We know this is new for you. We appreciate you being willing to hire TGNC individuals. So we're open. We're not so, we can't work with you. There's a lot of people need education.
Newman's group is the only one in the country that offers a national job board to help employers and potential employees connect. She believes creating a gender-diverse culture in the workplace has benefits.
Diversity, having someone from various backgrounds, makes for a very robust corporate structure. If everybody is the same, look the same, walk the same, talk the same, how do you get new ideals? How do you grow?
California has several new laws aimed at strengthening existing protections for transgender individuals, focusing on refugee status, healthcare access, and privacy. I'm Roz Brown.
Antonia Gonzalez has today's National Native News.
A team from the Canadian military has arrived at a Northern Manitoba First Nation, which is dealing with a severe water crisis. One of the reserve's water treatment plants has been out of commission for 2 weeks after a power outage. More from Dan Karpinchuk.
The power was out for days after a power line that ran between two islands on the Nelson River broke. Although power was restored after a couple of days, the outage resulted in frozen water systems, sewer backups, electrical issues, and burst pipes. About 4,400 residents were displaced after the reserve declared a state of emergency. Pimichikamak is more than 300 miles north of Winnipeg. The chief, David Monias, says a 7-member military team from the Joint Operational Support Group based in Kingston, Ontario, has arrived and will provide technical assistance and support related to critical infrastructure.
The Army, with their engineers and their logistics people, are going to be taking a look at they're doing a site tour on the water plant right now, take notes and identify what needs to be fixed and assess how it needs to be fixed and what resources are required to fix it.
Monias adds that nearly every one of the 1,300 homes in the community will need some kind of repairs. And band counselor Shirley Robinson says having so many people forced out of their homes in midwinter is taking an emotional toll.
They really want to go home. And there's that feeling of displacement, that feeling of isolation. that they can't be with their community.
Monias says a second military team is due to arrive. Meanwhile, plumbers and other skilled workers from outside the province are also on their way to Pimichicamac to help with water and electrical issues. And Monias says a U.S. company has reached out about sending a portable water plant to the First Nation. It's not the first time Pimichicamac residents were forced to leave their reserve. Many were forced to go south twice because of wildfires. I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Indigenous peoples across the U.S. have been swept up in the Trump administration's crackdown on undocumented immigrants. Gabriel Pietrazio reports an Arizona tribe is taking steps to safeguard its tribal members.
Thank you for calling the Hualapai Tribe's message line, where we encourage you to report any encounters with ICE agents.
The Hualapai Tribe near Kingman has set up a hotline.
Please leave your name and contact information, as well as the date, location, and a brief description of the incident. All information received will be checked and documented by tribal administration.
Hualapai Chairman Dwayne Clark is urging members to remain calm and always carry their tribal ID cards with them. His administration is also pledging to aid its 2,300 members in verifying their identity should they be held by federal authorities. This comes in the aftermath of a fatal shooting by an ICE agent in Minneapolis, also where four members of a South Dakota tribe have been detained. I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
Glad to have you with us here in the KBOO Evening News on this Thursday, January 15th, 2026.
This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes
Althea Billings, Josh Salem, and Isabel Charlet.
The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Our director of evening news is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at KBOO.